I believe in my powers.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I believe in the power of my teammates.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? Get cornered, bash them in the head. That seems to work out.
Now, what are we, a team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes chaos.
Gentlemen, I'm Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And
angels of love!
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanny Show. I'm Sean, and my very special guest today is David D. Levine.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you've been on the show once before. We were talking about religion, as I recall.
Okay.
This is, I think, over a year ago, so it's been a while. But now we're here to talk to you about an actual book. You have the book Arabella of Mars, a sort of, I don't know if steampunk would be the right word, but it has sort of that flavor. But involving space travel, ships of the line, and a dashing young lady as our hero.
Yes, I call it steampunkish rather than steampunk because there's no steam power in the book, but it's definitely steampunk-ish-y.
Close enough, right?
Yes. I call it a Regency Interplanetary Airship Adventure.
That is a much cooler title than steampunk. You should just go with that all the time.
Yeah, and in his blurb, Kim Stanley Robinson referred to it as sailpunk, and I can totally get behind that one. I mean, I don't object if people call it steampunk. I just, you know, if you're going to be definitional about it, it's a little bit too early for steam. There was steam power in the Regency, actually, but not on a retail level.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it would be the wrong era for sure. I do want to dive into the book. And one of the things I wanted to start with was actually your protagonist, because this story has, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but a familiar narrative of a woman posing as a young boy, mm-hmm. In order to sort of deal with some of the trials and tribulations of being a woman in a repressed or more conservative society when it comes to gender roles. And I really wondered, why did you immediately select that as your beginning point for the character and the sort of the basic plot for the novel?
Well, it's a pretty straightforward plot mechanics decision. You want a character to have a lot of problems to overcome. Basically, you want to have your. I mean, the reason so many adventure protagonists are orphans, are poor, are downtrodden. Are members of the lower classes is because it makes life harder on them. You know, if your main character is rich and powerful and remains rich and powerful throughout the book, well, then you're going to have to come up with some antagonists that are equally rich or more so and more powerful. I came up with a good analogy the other day. The hero of an opera is almost always a tenor. Whereas the villain is almost always a bass. And this is because the hero is the younger, higher voiced man who has to compete against the older, more powerful, lower voiced man. And so in the same way, I wanted my character to be somebody of lower power. And so in a historical drama, that would mean a young person, a woman. And in this case, by having her be a woman who dresses as a man, not only does she have all kinds of problems because of her age and gender, but by trying to disguise her age and gender, she actually makes the situation worse for herself. So this is all just kind of a plot mechanics thing, and that's why so many stories have used this idea.
It's a very interesting idea. I mean, it's one that still comes up in modern times, and it's one that we've seen in much older literature. I wonder if you would consider it to be, because our society still is not, I think it would be fair to say, not quite equal yet, it still has many leaps to go, whether you think that on some level it's sort of universal in societies that haven't reached an egalitarian society, that idea of sort of masking yourself, of passing, as it were, or in the trials that takes, something that is just, it will always be there so long as we do not have a society that is more equal.
Well, and even if we were to manage to achieve equality between men and women, there would still be differences between them. At least, that's the way things are right now. I mean, I suppose we could reach the point that we literally don't see gender, but that's got to be, you know, several generations in the future at the very soonest. So there would still be reasons for people to dress as the other gender, even if the two genders had equivalent power. But this ties into something that I have. It's a question that I don't have an answer for. It's been in my idea file for years and years, which is that there's a lot of stories of women dressing as men in order to have adventures and to exert their power in the world. Women dress as men in order to be more than themselves, in order to be more powerful, have more influence, or just have more freedom. The ability to wander around by themselves is something that dressing as a boy gives to a girl. Whereas if you look at stories that have men dressing as women, these are usually comedies. Men dress as women in order to hide, in order to infiltrate, or just for the comedic possibilities. And so one of the challenges that I've set myself, and I've never managed to come up with anything that does this, is to write a story in which a boy dresses as a girl in order to have an adventure and save the world. And I've declared as a rule for this game that using a gender flip world is cheating. So using sexual dynamics that are similar to our modern world, can you come up with a story in which a boy has to dress as a girl in order to save the world? And I haven't come up with a good answer to that. And I think that tells us something. Well, it certainly says something about me, and it definitely says something about our society that answering this question is so difficult.
It certainly does. As soon as you started talking about this, I don't know if you're familiar with this film, but it has a sweet spot in my heart. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Ah, yes.
Which, of course, is an example of a comedy. It is about cross-dressing men going on essentially an adventure through the Australian desert. It's a film with issues. I will admit it's got some problems with representations of Aboriginal people.
Yes.
Perhaps I would imagine.
But it's got a cock and a frock on a rock. What's not to love?
It's got a lot of really interesting things, and I know that it's intended as a comedy. But one thing I always found really interesting about it was the way in which that film manages to humanize people we normally would just make fun of. You know, they're people with very complicated, personalities and histories, right? I mean, like, for heaven's sakes, Hugo Weaving's character turns out to have a kid at the end, and that's very confusing because everyone is expecting him to be a gay man. He is sorta, kinda. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, so I believe
gay men can certainly have kids. I've been in quite a number of conversations where somebody used the term breeders, and I look around and I realize that I'm in a conversation with seven gay men and me and my wife, and the only people in that conversation who did not have children were me and my wife.
Oh, interesting.
Fairly common. But the thing about Priscilla, Queen in the Desert is that, yes, they are men dressed as women having an adventure, but the adventure is not dressing up as a girl is not something that they have to do in order to have an adventure.
Right.
The adventure is something that dressing as a girl makes more difficult. And is something that they do because they need a challenge or because that's who they are. It's not cross-dressing in order to make the plot happen, which is what happens in Arabella and so many other films. So many other stories. It's a plot that happens to people who are cross-dressing, if
right.
you catch the distinction.
Yeah, yeah. So for your sort of challenge for yourself, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert obviously doesn't fit. But
yes,
it came up because I love that movie.
Yeah, so. And I keep thinking about Some Like It Hot too. But that's again not an example of the kind of story I'm looking at.
Hopefully we have one. So, but going back to the book. So, I've kind of laid out already the main big plot element here, but we haven't really talked about the reason why she has to do this. And so one of the interesting things that happens in this book is in the very beginning of this, she's on Mars. She's having these kind of adventurous games in I suppose what you call the wilderness of Mars, as it were. She gets injured, and her mother finally says, "That's enough. We're going back home. You're going to become a prim and proper lady." And obviously, this is very troubling for our main character, who is, by no stretch of the imagination, a very prim and proper lady. She's an adventurous sort. She wants to be out in the wilderness. That's just not meant for someone of her stature, as it were. And so what ends up happening is she goes home fairly early in the book, so I'm not spoiling anything, and basically stumbles upon an in-family murder plot and must take action of her own in order to stop it, because she believes that essentially she's the only one in a position to do so. And so I wanted to talk about the family dynamic here, because one of the interesting things you bring up in this book is you're dealing with the role of inheritance and how that is transferred among families and the conflicts that that produces, particularly for this other fellow, who has put himself in a position where he believes he has to murder the heir, as it were, to the family fortune in order to improve his own station, as though this is the appropriate act. Well, I suppose he recognizes it's not appropriate. He knows it's not appropriate, I guess, would be the more fair assessment. And I was wondering, as you were doing research for this work, presumably you did research to kind of get a better sense of this world.
No, I made up the English Regency out of whole cloth. Yes, no, whole of course cloth. I did plenty of research.
Sorry, that came out the wrong way. But as you were sort of looking at the sort of family dynamics of that world, what kind of things leapt out to you in your research in terms of very unusual or perhaps very conflict-ridden elements that sort of come up here?
Well, anybody who's read anything set in the Regency, in large swaths of English history, knows about the concept of entail. If an inheritance is entailed, that means that the whole estate has to pass down to whoever is the inheritor in one big lump and cannot be divided. This is something that was put into place, I think, in the medieval period. The idea is that if you allow the estate to be divided among all the children, then after just a few generations, it's broken down into pieces that are so small that nobody's a noble anymore. So the entail is designed to concentrate the power, to keep the money and the land in big chunks in as few hands as possible. And this is something that works very well for the people in power, so it's been maintained for a long time. And if you go to a convention and ask 50 people who read Regencies, what does it take to break an entail? I think probably just about everybody who's ever read a Regency romance or really any drama set in the Regency, certainly anybody who's read Jane Austen, will know what an entail is. And most people believe, as I believed when I began researching this, that it actually requires an act of parliament to break an entail. And one of the things that I learned during my research was that it's actually possible to break an entail through other means. And that's part of the climax, so I'm not going to say anything more about that. But the entail, the idea of entail drove the plot, and then actually drove the family tree. I had to make, in order to give the antagonist the motivation that he has to travel to Mars and attempt murder, I had to actually prune the family tree back quite a bit, because if it was a typical family tree with lots of cousins and uncles and aunts, then it wouldn't be that easy to seize the fortune. I had to make sure that there weren't a lot of other relatives to get in the way. So my plot drove the creation of the family. And so it's a combination of English law, family dynamics, and the needs of the plot that created the particular relations that exist in this book.
That is very interesting, because, of course, the solution you come up with, as I kind of mentioned, right, is, well, I should say, the solution that's presented to us is this fellow's going to go murder the heir to the throne, as it were, not literally a throne, but
yes, the heir to the fortune.
In order to better himself. And his, of course, problem is not just that he is sort of on the bottom of the bucket in terms of access to the wealth, but that he has sort of gambled away, as it were, their finances to the point that he's in a point of desperation, which I found really interesting because it seems very familiar. I was just watching today part of a documentary about, I believe his name is David Siegel, the Westgate timeshare guy, as an example of this, of somebody who has lost all of his wealth literally through gambling, but through the combinations of bad fortune, as it were, and sort of his struggle to kind of maintain his life. And then this is a sort of opposite version of that. This is a person who doesn't have a lot of wealth, but who has gambled what little they have away and is now put in that sort of desperate motion. And I found that really fascinating, I think mostly because of the way in which it affected Arabella, who comes to the situation after her father's passed away. Again, I'm not spoiling it. This is in the first few chapters, so this is not like 300 pages into the book, right? She's come to this situation where she thinks she's going with family, but what she's getting is actually even greater conflict than what she began with. And in a way, it kind of forces her to sort of let go of temporarily of the grief of losing her father, which I found very fascinating. And I'm not sure if that's what you kind of intended was sort of as this is an emotional breaking point for the character, or if it was something that sort of just developed sort of organically.
Basically, you keep piling problems onto the main character until they do what you want them to do. I mean, look at Star Wars, right? I mean, the death of his aunt and uncle is a big driving point for Luke. Does he ever think about Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru again after he leaves Tatooine? I mean, honestly, does he?
Not that we're told, no.
There's no sign of it, yeah. So you know, this is what we call a linking problem or a linking plot. This is you've got to have somebody with some kind of problem in order to get going. And then once things are moving, you throw more and more problems at them to make them keep going. I'm not saying that Arabella's father and her other relatives don't matter to her. They certainly do. But as far as keeping the plot moving, that is linking. The hat that I'm wearing at the moment is kind of the author talking about plot mechanics as though to other writers kind of hat, rather than the oh I love my characters and I care about them and I feel for them kind of hat that might I mean kind of depends on who's listening to this podcast, but I am a fairly I write from the head rather than the heart. For me, coming up with emotions is the hard part. Coming up with plots is easy. I know an awful lot of my writer friends have the opposite problem. So I actually create problems for my characters in order to cynically invoke emotions in the breasts of my readers. And so this is a situation that I have deliberately created to make my character's life terrible, just to make her a more sympathetic character.
That's fascinating, because you're right that I think a lot of writers would describe it as somewhat their opposite sort of approach, right? That they would see that playing on the emotions of the characters would be much more easier than playing on the plot to get to that same effect.
Yep.
Do you find that you're sort of in the minority in that respect, or?
I believe I am. Yeah, I am as a plot focused writer. I believe I am in the minority. Mind you, this book was an unusual one for me. I know an awful lot of writers who refer to their projects by the name of the main character. You know, they'll say things like, oh, I'm going to work on Freddy now. These characters are friends of theirs. They live in their heads, and they like to spend time with these people. And these people often complain that their characters are just sitting around having tea and not protagging, you know, they're not making plot happen. Whereas my problem is quite the opposite. I have my characters doing stuff, but they don't have any genuine emotion. Arabella has been different for me from the beginning. I actually called this project Arabella. I mean, I think of the whole project that now we're working on books two and three now. I think of the whole project as Arabella. This is Arabella's story, and Arabella, very unusually for me, has been called Arabella from the beginning. I will very often rename my main character several times, often quite late in the process, as I come up with a name that seems to be more evocative of who this person is trying to be. But Arabella is kind of herself, and she has been this person fairly fully fledged from very early in this project. So I think one reason this book has been as successful as it is because I'm getting to be more of a heart-centered rather than a head-centered writer. And this is something that I've been working on for many years and almost certainly will continue to do so for my entire career.
So, I got to ask a weird question. Obviously you say that you've been working towards something like this. What do you think finally made things click for this particular work in your head?
Finally, it was a combination of writing three unsold novels and learning the process of writing a novel. I mean, when I wrote my first novel, I thought, hey, I've written like 30 short stories at this point. I should be able, it's time I should be able to write a novel. And indeed, I did write a structurally competent novel. It had the beginning and the middle and the end and the plot and the characters and the setting and all those things. And really, a lot of people who read it liked it, but it didn't sell. And then novels two and three also did not sell. And the process of writing three unsold novels was part of the learning process of preparing to write a novel that people would actually want to pay money for. And then also just personal maturity, going through life and it's all of its joys and tragedies, made me a bigger person than I was 5 years ago. I eventually became the kind of person that could write this book, through all of my life experiences and all of my writing experiences. Also, Arabella is, my first three books were all fairly hard science fiction. And I was getting, one of the reasons that they weren't selling, several people told me, was that science fiction just is a hard sell right now. Now, you can look at things like The Expanse and argue that science fiction is actually doing very well. But I kept getting people, editors and agents, telling me science fiction just isn't selling. So I cast about, I looked at my idea file for an idea that was science fictional enough for my own personal satisfaction, because I really do enjoy writing science fiction more than fantasy, but close enough to fantasy that it would be more saleable. And so Arabella, the whole thing about this universe, this world with the flying sailing ships and all that, is my deliberate steering a path between science fiction and fantasy to find something that feels like science fiction but also feels like fantasy. And so it's, maybe that's the thing that made this book sell when the previous three did not.
So this leads me into one of the things I really wanted to talk about, because you've kind of brought this up for me. This is a book that is a lot different from some of the stuff that you're perhaps better known for, which is, as you noted, right, more hard science fiction, more straight science fiction, if not hard, then certainly very straight.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, straight is the wrong word. We can't use that word anymore.
Straightforward.
Straightforward science fiction. Thank you. And this book is, as we kind of suggested, right, it sort of bears more resemblance to maybe steampunk, even though it's not literally steampunk, than to the sort of more traditional science fiction. And one of the interesting things you do here is you actually kind of show how these flying ships of the line would work in space. And I was really curious about that, because as soon as I started reading this book, and I mentioned this on podcast, that I didn't know how the hell you were going to do this, right? Because it's kind of crazy, right? So you either have to do one of two things. You have to do the, it's just magic and we're not going to even like discuss it thing, and it's just a flying ship in space, whatever. Or you're going to actually try to explain it, and you kind of go for the alternate route in explaining it. And obviously from what you had said to me, that this seems obviously intentional, that you wanted this to be there because it sort of pushes your science fiction buttons.
Exactly.
And I found that so much fun, just seeing so much of what's the way the ship operates. The first time Arabella experiences more or less zero gravity when they just pick her up and throw her around. That was really funny for me. So I was curious that when you were developing the science, as it were, for how this worked, it's obviously not our physics. At least based on my rudimentary understanding of physics. So what were you drawing upon? Were you just kind of like throwing things out of the hat, or was there kind of an internal logic you were developing as you were creating this flying ship world?
Basically what I wanted to do was hew as close as possible to real physics while still having the fun stuff be able to happen. The original idea that I had, way back when I was just doing world building and didn't even have any plot, I do world building first. And at that time, I had the idea that I was going to make one big change in the world, which was I was going to fill the solar system with air and have everything else be hard science fiction. It turned out that that didn't work. If you really did have a solar system full of air, for one thing, probably before life would have a chance to evolve, the planets would be decelerated by passing through the atmosphere and spiral into the sun. Air is not really that transparent, so you probably wouldn't be able to see the sun There'd just sort of be a dim red glow. So I had to make the interplanetary atmosphere something that's breathable, but a lot more transparent than air. And also the even with, you know, if you had sailing ships that were able to travel between the planets, it would take thousands of years at sailing ship velocities. So I had to make the winds unreasonably fast and the solar system actually unreasonably small. I have not gone into any detail about exactly how much smaller this solar system is, but I just waved my authorly hand and said, it's small enough that you can travel to Mars in less than a year, a couple months. So there's a certain amount of hand waving, I'm going to make it this way just to make the plot work the way that I want it to. And there's a certain amount of, okay, so given this premise, how could you make it fly? And that is something that this is high school and college level physics. I do not have the numbers. I have not worked out the equations. I do believe that you'd have to lower the force of gravity considerably in order for this to work. So I think the value of G is considerably smaller in this universe. But I have made it feel more plausible by saying things like, oh, the ships are built of an implausibly light and strong wood from Mars, and the balloons are built of an implausibly light and strong silk from Venus. But some of the things like the three-masted schooner with the three masts and a triangle, two down, one up, this is just, well, if you did have a flying ship in midair, well, that might be something that you would actually do. One of the big problems is that if the ship is floating in zero gravity in the middle of air and you put up sails, you can't direct yourself. The sails, a balloon, for example, regular hot air balloon on our world, you can't put sails on the balloon in order to direct it. It will just, if you put up sails, then the balloon will just come up to speed in whatever air current that it's in more quickly. But basically, a balloon already is a sail. And so it will drift with the wind. And so actually when you're standing in the basket of a balloon, it feels calm, even if the wind is blowing quite stiffly. So putting sails on a ship floating in zero gravity will not actually let you direct it. What you need is some form of propulsion. You need a dirigible with an engine. And so in this 1800s world, I have pedal power. I have the sailors pedaling the ship with a big pusher propeller at the back of the ship. And so in this world, I say that you can always tell an aerial sailor by his enormous calves and thighs. and so, can they actually direct enough? Can they actually produce enough propulsion to get up a reasonable head of steam? Maybe. I don't know. I haven't done the math. I just threw enough of the physics that I know at the problem to make it feel plausible. And so the idea that I had is that you would use the pedal, you take down the sails, so the air resistance of the ship is low. You use the pedals until you push the ship into an air current that is going the direction you want, then you put all the sails up. So then you catch the breeze and the ship is borne along in that breeze until you come to the next place where you want to make a turn, take the sails down again and pedal again. So this is something, would it actually work? The point is that it feels plausible enough. And if you throw enough jargon at it, if you talk about the spars, the spars and the lanyards and the halyards and throw in all of that nautical gibberish that I have from many, many years of reading Patrick O'Brien, then it feels real. And that feeling of realness, that feeling of actually being in a completely different world, is one of the things that makes people enjoy reading science fiction.
And it would certainly, maybe you would agree with this, that it becomes a component that makes even something more fantastical more believable, that it feels as though it actually exists rather than just saying, like, here's just a fantastic thing and don't ask any questions.
It just goes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what, I mean, the term imaginary gardens with real toads in them is thrown around. This is one of the basic principles of science fiction writing is if you have enough plausible, convincing details early on, if you really make the reader believe that, okay, this alchemist lab has been so beautifully described, and I know that the astrolabe is made of brass and is slightly pitted, and this bit of glass here is a little bit cracked, and I smell the smells, and I feel how sticky the surfaces are, and then when the demon appears, it's like, okay, you know, I'm prepared to accept that this demon is real because I accept that the astrolabe is real. And so this business of describing a completely invented world in great detail is just, that's one of the main techniques of science fiction, is making it feel believable so that when the truly fantastic stuff comes along, people will just buy it. There are a couple of things in here that, as I said, even though I started off with the idea of writing it as hard science fiction with one big change, there are some things in here that, no question, are absolutely pure fantasy. But I'm not going to tell you which ones they are, because most people have just accepted them.
I think I know what one of them is, but we won't say it on podcast.
Yes, because that would be a spoiler.
That would be a spoiler. So I want to switch tactics a little bit, because I do love all of the scientific elements, but one of the characters in this book, I think is your play on Captain Nemo. And I don't know if that is the case. And maybe I'm just, my little literary brain is trying to make connections. But you have a character by the name of Captain Prakash Singh, who flies a quote unquote Mars Company ship. This is the term you use to refer to the ships. The ship Diana, who is a very stoic kind of figure, very imposing, strong figure, runs a very strict ship, but is a very fascinating character.
Yes, he is from India. I haven't actually nailed down his religion. I believe with the name Singh, he is almost certainly a Sikh. But I believe he's fairly well, he's fairly secular. He has been abandoned by his family, and he is more British than Indian, just by virtue of the fact that he has lived in the Mars Company for basically his entire adult life. So I don't think he's culturally very Indian, but he is Indian by heritage. It's great that you bring up Nemo. I didn't really model him on Nemo consciously, but I bet there's some aspects of it in there. I had a horrible, horrible experience just a few weeks ago when I watched on YouTube a clip of a cartoon that I loved when I was a kid. It was called Fantastic Voyage, which was a cartoon based on the idea of the movie Fantastic Voyage from the 60s, which is that you have these people who can be shrunk down to microscopic size, and they have various adventures. And I was watching this thing, and I was appalled when one of the characters came on, and this guy's name is Guru. Guru is his whole and entire name, and that is what he's called, and that is what he is, and that is what he does. He is Guru, the master of mystic forces, and he is this tall, slim Indian fellow with a turban, and all he has to do is close his eyes and concentrate, and mystical things happen. And I'm looking at this guy and saying, oh my God, I cannot believe this racist caricature is lodged in my head, and I think Captain Singh was actually partially based on him. Only partially. I did make sure, I've worked in high tech for most of my career, and I know a lot of Indians. I've worked with a lot of people of Indian heritage and people from India, and who have often returned to India. And so I did ask one of my Indian friends to read the book as a sensitivity reader, and he loved it. He's actually become a huge fan. Very, very. He's been promoting the book. So I think that
that's wonderful.
At least one Indian reader found the Indian character to be acceptable. And you know, having some of my best friends are black, what have you. Having just a few, a small number of people approve multicultural character doesn't let me off the hook. It's entirely possible that I have done some racist things with the character. Nobody's called me on it yet. But if it should occur, if somebody should come along and say, hey, you know, this character is really racially insensitive, I would hope that I would be mature enough to say, wow, I didn't realize that. So sorry. I will do more research and try and do better next time, because that's about all you can do with a book once it's been published. Multiculturalism is an important thing to me. I did try to get a lot of, even though most of the characters are white men, I did try to get some non-white, non-male characters in there. This book takes place in a very, very white, very male kind of environment. But I'm trying to get even more non-white, non-men, and non-human characters into books 2 and 3.
Yeah, and that is an interesting point because keep bringing up steampunk because it's just the thing that has to come up. One of the great criticisms of steampunk, and again, your book's not technically steampunk, but is it takes place in a period, but oftentimes, and not always, but many times, steampunk seems to wipe away some of the very real social problems occurring in, you know, the late 19th century Victorian period, right? The fact that we're at the height of colonialism and all these mm-hmm. kinds of things. And your period, I mean, a little bit different in terms of the exact period you've selected, but still has some of those issues. So wiping that away would be sort of, honestly, would be a kind of unbelievable fantasy.
It would be a cheat, yeah. And I've tried to acknowledge colonialism without having it take over the book. And again, this becomes more and more of a factor in books 2 and 3. But I, you know, I don't want to whitewash history. I don't want to ignore the problems of colonialism. I have read a couple of reviews that take the book to task for treading too lightly on that topic. And I'm not going to argue. I think that's a fair critique. I think I could have done more. I do intend to do more. And, you know, it's a big, big topic. And I didn't want my own politics to get in the way of having it be an entertaining story. And certainly, you know, we can talk about how much politics can you put in without getting in the way of being an entertaining story? And it's possible that other writers than I could have worked in more politics without making it not be an entertaining story. I'm tap dancing as fast as I can, and I'm trying to be politically honest and sensitive, while at the same time being an entertainer. And so, you know, with the goodwill that I hope this book builds up, I should be able to do more with that in future books.
So listening to you talk about that, you describe it as basically like a tap dance. And I think that's a great way of thinking about it, like kind of tiptoeing in a way around this very delicate balance. And I will just say as a compliment, you have an amazing sense of humility, which is wonderful to hear in a writer acknowledging they could at any moment be screw up and you just have to go roll with the punches and keep trying.
Yeah, well, I've shown my ass in public. I made a terrible ass of myself during Race Fail back in 2004 it was. And I learned a lot from that. I've actually been on a couple of panels about how to fail gracefully. And you know, no question, I failed. I blew it. And I learned from that I didn't handle it well, and I still feel bruised. About the way I was treated, and at the same time, I can acknowledge that I messed up, and that's one of the things that I learned from the experience. And I really, I'm trying to be a responsible human being and fess up when I mess up. And I mean, an effective apology consists of acknowledging what you did wrong. Acknowledging the hurt that you've done, making a concerted effort to figure out what went wrong and not do it again, and offer to make reparations. And that's just basic politesse. And so, you know, I've seen plenty of authors really mess up on issues of race, gender, colonialism, etc. And I really hope not to be that guy. Which is not to say that people may not lose their stuff at me. But if they lose their stuff at me, I will try to take it in stride.
That is a very good policy. I'm doing like a thumbs up. I realize I'm doing a thumbs up on a podcast, which you can't see. So this is the most ridiculous thing in the world, but
I'm giving you two thumbs up right back.
So let's switch to another element. While we still have a little bit of time left here, mm-hmm. You have aliens.
Yes. Yes. There are Martians.
There are Martians. What?
Of course there are Martians. I mean, if you got flying sailing ships and Martian and British plantations on Mars in the 1800s, of course there are Martians, and of course they are crab-like. They had to be either crab-like or insectile, right? And of course there are Venusians. Of course Venus is swampy, and of course there are Venusians, and of course they are frog-like. You know, this is just this is part of what makes it fun, is harking back to the old tropes of what the other planets might be like, the planetary romance. This is my model was a series of stories about a character called Northwest Smith, written by C.L. Moore back in the 40s. And this harks back to a bunch of older planetary romances, including Edgar Rice Burroughs, and frankly, going all the way back to what's his name with the big nose? Not Quixote. Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, okay.
Wrote a fantasia of voyaging to the moon and beyond. And so, you know, these ideas that these very simplistic, very small steps away from Earth life into imagining that aliens are not all that different from us. I mean, I think if I were writing hard science fiction, the aliens would be far more different from humans and far less comprehensible. But this is a fun adventure. It's a light, fluffy beach book. And so I wanted to have aliens who would feel familiar and be immediately acceptable. So of course there are Martians on Mars. What fun would it be to have a Mars that was an uninhabited desert? And the fact that they are fairly stereotypical Martians is just part of the fun.
So there's a great scene in this book fairly early on when another character refers to Martians as looking like crabs in an offensive way. And the character, Arabella says, that's actually a really offensive thing. But of course, she's supposed to be prim and proper. So she says, of course, I understand now in retrospect, having seen a crab, that they look somewhat crab-like.
There is a certain resemblance, yeah.
And I found that really interesting because it was this very light touch that you put in there of kind of recognizing this sort of inherent biases and perhaps even bigotry that exists in English society in your universe.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this is something that is I think it's a sign of a good writer, and I'm giving you another compliment.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And the thing is what's going, and this is engineering. The early chapters of a book are where you set the rule, where you set up the rules. And so that little exchange there, of the cousin referring to Martians as crabs, using an insult, referring to Martians. But the thing is that from her perspective, from the cousin's perspective, it was not an insult. That's just what we call them. They're just crabs. They're just darkies. I mean, you know, in our timeline, in the early 1900s, the British military command, this may be an apocryphal story, but I'm going to repeat it anyway. British military command reminded the enlisted men that these are, you know, please do not call the Indian natives by derogatory names. They are worthy Oriental gentlemen, and this worthy Oriental gentleman turned into an acronym, and so WOG became a derogatory term, and so when. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who would talk about darkies and wogs and other things even more offensive without even realizing how offensive it is. Things like the word gypsy. Many, many white people do not know that the word gypsy is offensive.
Yeah.
So lots of people will use these offensive terms without even realizing them. So by having the term crab exist in the lexicon, having the cousin, the Earthborn cousin, refer to Martians as crabs just in passing, and having Arabella pipe up and say, well, actually, that term is an insult, because, of course, she would know it. She would know the term, and she would know that it's not well meant. This is, you know, that very small exchange is world building, because it shows the extent to which England is aware of Martians. It shows the attitudes that the English gentry has toward Martians, and it shows how Arabella is unlike her peers in this way, in that she knows and respects Martians. And to her, a crab, an actual literal Earth crab, is an alien being, which she had never seen until she was dragged back to Earth by her mother.
It is a really nice touch, I think, to have these very subtle elements. And one of the other elements that is sort of the underlying politics here is you actually have the war over with Bonaparte in the sort of background for much of the story.
Yes.
And I love this because you've taken so this the early 1800s is like the tail end of the era of piracy. Like the Golden Age is what I think the late 1700s. There's still pirates running around, but most of them become privateers, I think, for the British and the French by the early 1800s, if I recall correctly. So you used to have pirates in this world, right? That this worry that between the travel between the planets, there's piracy, but you're also worried about the French could show up at any moment and raid your ship, especially if it's a British ship. And I love that this is sort of underlying threat always there. And I was curious how you saw yourself trying to weave in this typically terrestrial conflict. They didn't have dirigibles, as far as I'm aware, for Bonaparte, unless he was doing some crazy things in a barn somewhere. Sort of weaving that into this new narrative of sort of space travel. I was curious how you did that. Yeah.
It's a straightforward extension. I mean, if you know, the European powers spread out across the globe, and you know, the war with Bonaparte was a world war. If you've read any of the Patrick O'Brien books, you know that the English Navy and French ships were fighting each other not just in the Channel and in the Mediterranean, but all over the world. I mean, the Master and Commander movie, which actually was derived from a couple of different Patrick O'Brien books, one of which was called The Far Side of the World, so the Master and Commander movie actually takes place, much of the action takes place in the Pacific. They followed that a French ship was dispatched to the Pacific to harry the English whaling fleets. And so Patrick O'Brien's characters were dispatched to the Pacific in order to track down this particular French ship. So because the Napoleonic Wars really extended all around the world, in a world where the planets have been colonized, of course the Napoleonic Wars would have continued into space. And the wars get even bigger in subsequent books. I actually hate this when people do this, but as somebody who is now in the process of committing trilogy, I'm afraid I find myself doing it myself. But the marketing description of the book, the one that you see on Amazon.com and the cover flap and all, the first version of the cover flap copy ended with the words "Napoleon in space." And I go, this is a very exciting blurb, but I'd like those few words taken out because Napoleon doesn't actually appear in the book. But that phrase, Napoleon in space, is so evocative that it keeps, I mean, you look at Tor's tweet stream and you see those words, Napoleon in space, all over the place. I'll never get away from that. Now, fortunately, Napoleon does appear in book two. I mean, Napoleon is in space in book one, but Napoleon himself doesn't appear as a character. He does appear in book two. And actually, you talk about pirates versus privateers. In the first draft of Arabella of Mars, book one, Arabella was menaced by pirates. And actually, I changed them from pirates to French privateers or corsairs, just to get that Napoleonic war thing more present in the book, because it just raises the level of menace.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. For those that don't know, the British and the French basically paid off most of the pirates to basically work for their various empires.
Yeah.
The Americans
A privateer is basically... I mean, looked at one way, a privateer is nothing but a pirate with a license. Alternatively, a privateer is a privately owned ship of war.
Yes, yes. And it's very fascinating. I'm writing my dissertation, and one of my chapters is on a pirate novel written by a Caribbean author. And it's really fun to sort of learn, like, how important piracy was in the various imperial fights, whether it was the American Revolutionary War. There were hundreds of privateer ships that the Americans purchased, they're the British. It's all very fascinating. You all should read this stuff. It's just exciting.
Well, you go back in history. You go all the way back to, say, Henry VIII. There was no English Navy. There was Henry VIII's private fleet. And so the idea of having a navy that actually belongs to the nation rather than to individuals, that's newer. You know, the idea that an individual, somebody with a lot of money, would kit up a ship and go out and harass the enemy. You know, that's the older and more fundamental concept. You know, the idea of a professional navy and a standing army, that's newer.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird when you think about it, because the latter, the doing it on your own kind of thing seems weird today, right? But obviously it's something that people did.
Yeah, well, back in feudal times, of course, your power as a duke or a baron or what have you was largely related to how many men you could raise up in time of war.
I would be screwed because it would be like five.
Well, you would probably not be a member of the nobility. Odds are again it.
I'm going to be House Mormont. That's what I'm going to be. That's going to be a Game of Thrones reference for anybody watching.
And they did so well.
Nah, yeah, fair. Well, wonderful. So I know we're getting pretty close to the end here. So that means we got to kind of wander off into questions about things you've already mentioned, which is that you are working on two more books in this series to come out through Tor. My guess is then we're expecting the second book some point next year.
Yes. I just recently found out something that I'm not sure whether I'm free to mention yet. But okay, so yeah, book two. I have turned in a first draft of book two already, and it will probably come out right around the same time next year in July. Book three, I have not yet started. And it took me, I've never written a novel in less than 2 years. And so I have less than 1 year to write book three. And I'm also unfortunately, undergoing some family health crises. So, I will admit up front that there's a possibility book three may be late, but I will do my darndest. And I will definitely have no impression. I have no intention of following, George R. R. Martin and other people who get later and later with every book. I will do my darndest to get that book, to get book three done a year after book two. And if I can't, then I will, I'll just knock myself out. I really will. I really, really will. And I certainly do not intend to let them get longer and more complex with every volume, as I've seen happen to many, many writers, not just George.
Fair enough. Well, I feel like if you've got a lot of stuff going on personally, you get a pass.
Yeah, everybody, my publisher and everybody else has been very, very supportive. Unfortunately, I just had to cancel one of my planned readings, and at this point, I don't even know if I'm going to be able to go to the Worldcon. It actually is a very serious problem, but I'm trying not to let it get too much in the way of what's going on with this book, because I've been working toward this. I started writing this book in 2011, so this book has been 5 years in the making. I've been trying to sell a novel for 10 years, and I've been working as a science fiction writer for 15 years. So the publication of Arabella of Mars, my first novel, is a really significant milestone for me, and I don't want to lose it no matter how much else is going on in my life.
That's fair. Well, I hope whatever's going on, that it gets sorted, that everything turns out okay, because that's a lot. I know it's like to deal with family crises, as it were, whatever they may be. It can be very tough. So hopefully it all turns out okay. But other than the second novel, which presumably you'll be working at edits over the next few months, a year.
Yes.
But what else are you working on that you could let us know about?
I am a member of the Wild Cards Consortium, which is a, this, in case you're not familiar with it, this is a series of books, this is edited by George R. R. Martin, at the head of a consortium, which has been, there's a large number of people that have been involved with this from the beginning. George R. R. Martin and Melinda Snodgrass are the primary editors, but really it's a group effort and has been from the beginning. It's a shared world. This is basically a superhero comic in prose form. It has been going for a long time. It's been going since the 80s. And volume 23 in this long-running series is just coming out this summer. And I was honored to be invited to be a member of the Wild Cards Consortium a few years ago. I have published several stories in the consortium. I had a story in the revised version of book one, so I got a chance to write a new story to be added to the revised version of book one. I have another story in the most recently published book, Lowball, which is volume 22, and I have a standalone story which appeared on Tor.com last summer called Discards. And that one is actually a pretty good jumping on point. I wrote it so that it would work even if you hadn't read any of the other Wildcard stories. And so I am working right now on another story for one of the upcoming Wildcards volumes, which is actually not a character that I invented. This is a character who is a long-running character who has not been seen in a couple of decades. And I'm really, really thrilled at the opportunity to work with this long-standing character whom I really loved when I first read the books when I was in college.
That is fascinating. It always amazes me how many Wildcards books there are.
Yeah.
It's been going for a very long time.
And I describe this as being probably as close as I'm likely to come to writing for television. Because as with television, you're working with a lot of other people. You're writing about characters that you didn't create, characters that other people have created and written about and that other people will go on to work with after you're done with them. And working with a very excellent showrunner. George R. R. Martin is probably the best editor I've ever worked with. He has an amazing ability to take a look at a draft of a story and identify exactly what change is needed to make it work ever so much better, which is not to say that it's easy to do the things that he's asked for, but it's really straightforward for him to describe it. He has an amazing eye, and I think that is why he's become so successful.
That is wonderful. So you'll have a new story coming out in the relatively near future for an upcoming volume, but they can also get Lowball, which
Lowball's out now. Yeah.
Yep. And they can go on tor.com and get Discards.
Discards. Right. Yes.
So that's awesome. So they got a whole ton of David Levine works to read right this second.
Yes. And I will be, as soon as I can get my feet under me, I'll be putting together another collection of short stories. My first short story collection, Space Magic, came out in 2009. And I've written two Nebula nominees since then, and a lot of other stories. So it's definitely time to put together another collection. And I'll be putting that out. I'll be putting that out in some fashion. I'll be shopping it to publishers, and if I can't find a publisher, then I'll probably bring it out myself through Bookview Cafe. And so that second short story collection will be coming out at some point in the next year or two, one way or another. And at some point, I hope to get back to short fiction because I really do love it, and I mean to write some more stories. There are tons of story opportunities in the Arabella universe because Arabella already has two stories that have been published, two novelette length stories, one of which takes place on Mars in the 1702, and the other takes place on Venus in 1939. So there's 200 years of alternate history to play with here. And I've got tons of, I've got Ben Franklin with Martians. I've got Shackleton at Jupiter. There's the question of what's happening with the American Revolution. A lot of story ideas in this universe, plus all the many other universes that are knocking around the back of my head.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So, so for folks who want to find, more about your work, they can go to, if I'm correct, it's daviddlevine.com.
daviddlevine.com. Yes.
Right, so the and D I'm also, is important.
The D is important. Yeah. I always use my middle initial because David Levine is actually a pretty common name. If you just search on David Levine, there was a caricaturist for the New Yorker magazine, a very famous artist by that name. And if you Google on just David Levine, there's no possible way I could get myself into the first 10 pages of Google Hits with his enormous popularity and long career. So I always use my middle initial professionally. And so that's why it's daviddlevine.com. And I'm also David D. Levine on Twitter.
Excellent. Well, so folks should go check out the work. Go get Arabella of Mars. It's out from Tor. So they're really awesome to get it out through Tor because Tor's like my favorite major publisher. So
I was so jazzed when I got the contract from them. And I'd like to point out, by the way, that it is suitable for adults and for young adults. There's no sex, no swearing, and the protagonist is 70.
That's interesting. I hadn't actually thought about that. And then you're right. You're right. Yes. It reminds me of Fran Wilde's Updraft in that respect.
Yes, and like Updraft, I mean, you know, Updraft was of course nominated for both the Nebula and the young adult equivalent, and so I would love for something like that to happen to Arabella.
Well, you never know. You never know. Got a whole year, could happen. So, so thanks so much, David, for coming to talk to me and for giving me an opportunity to read this book, which is a lot of fun this week to sort of finish off. It's been a lot of fun.
It has absolutely been my pleasure.
Excellent. So on that note, folks, it's not really an awkward ending, but I'm going to make it awkward. So now it's awkward. Awkward ending and scene. Our intro and outro music comes from Nocturnia by Psychedelic Pedestrian. You can find out more about them on freemusicarchive.org, including the full version of the song. We obviously made some edits to the song, including sound effects and, of course, shortening the length. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us a suggestion, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and check out the little suggested topic form at the top there. You can also just send us emails. You can also find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty or on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just search for us on there. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time.